England There, England by A.G. MacDonald. Adapted in six parts by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips. Episode 3.
Don't forget Saturday morning, stop. Charing Cross Tube, stop. 10:15 sharp, stop. Whatever you do, don't be late, stop. Hodge.
Thus ran the telegram from the editor of the London Weekly to his latest literary and cricketing recruit, the young Scot Donald Cameron, whom regular listeners will recall has been endeavouring to write a book about the English and their many curious customs. It was 12:30 when the nine cricketers eventually started off, and 2 hours later, after halts at the Dog and Duck in Catford, the White Hart, Sevenoaks, the Blue Angel, Tunbridge Wells, and three smaller inns in three small villages, the Sharabang drew up triumphantly beside the cricket ground in the Kentish village of Fordenden. Donald was enchanted at his first sight of rural England. In the Sharabang, he'd been tightly wedged between a young and extremely learned ballistics professor and a very stout publisher with a persistent laugh which caused him to quiver like a seismograph needle during one of Japan's larger earthquakes. Now the young Scot sprang free and gazed eagerly round at the hot summer's afternoon. The clock on the flint tower of the church struck the half hour, and the vibrations spread slowly across the shimmering hedgerows, lost themselves tremulously among the orchards. The cricket field itself was a mass of daisies, buttercups, and dandelions, except, of course, for the oblong patch in the centre, mown, rolled, watered, a smooth, shining emerald of grass, the pride of Fordenden, the wicket. The entire scene was perfect to the last detail. There stood the vicar, beaming absent-mindedly. There was the forge with the blacksmith hammer discarded, tightening his snake-buckled belt for the fray and loosening his braces to enable his terrific bowling arm to swing freely in its socket. There, on a long bench outside the Three Horseshoes, sat a row of elderly gaffers with pint tankards, and near them was another group of rather younger men, some of whom seemed familiar to Donald. But it wasn't till he'd turned back to the Sharabang to see if he could help with the luggage that he realised they were members of his own team, already sampling the proprietor's wares. At 10:50, the match began. Mr. Hodge won the toss and sent in the opening pair to bat. James Livingstone, very sound club cricketer and a huge, awe-inspiring colossus of a man called simply Boone. Watching from what passed for the pavilion, Donald couldn't help but voice his misgiving.
It doesn't seem fair, Harcourt.
I know. If Hodge kept the captain busy for just 5 more minutes, we could have got another round in.
That man Boone.
What about him?
Well, he's bigger than most of the villages we've been through. Besides, I hear he's a Cambridge Blue. Hardly seems fair letting him loose on, well...
These poor defenceless yokels, is that what you're going to say? Well, before you patronise them, just take a peep at the bowler.
Good heavens.
Village blacksmith.
How can you be so sure?
Well, look at him. He's hardly the vicar, is he?
I suppose not. Just a minute. Why is he disappearing over the brow of that hill?
Sloping pitch, old man. You watch. He'll come thundering back in a minute.
Mr. Harcourt was right. Having taken guard, Mr. Livingstone, the sound club player, was somewhat surprised to find that although the field was ready, no bowler was visible. His confusion was resolved a second or two later when the blacksmith roared up, breasting the slope superbly like a mettlesome Vulcan. The first ball he delivered was a high, full-pitched leg of appalling velocity. It rocketed, first bounce into the hedge, and 4 byes were reluctantly signalled by the village umpire. The row of gaffers on the rustic bench shook their heads.
What do you think, then, George?
Well, we haven't seen four boys given on this pitch for many a long year, I'd say. What do you say, Jim?
Many a long year, I'd say, George.
More beer it is, then.
The other members of Mr. Hodges' team blanched visibly, and the young ballistics professor started doing a sum on the back of an envelope. The second ball went full pitch into the wicketkeeper's stomach. And there was a delay, while his deputy was invested with the pads and gloves of office. The third ball, making a noise like a partridge, would have hummed past Mr. Livingston's left ear had he not dexterously struck it out of the ground for six. And the fourth took his leg bail with a bullet-like full pitch. 10 runs, 1 wicket. Last man, 6. The ballistics professor, who'd spent the last 3 balls engrossed in mathematical calculations, threw his envelope aside and strode confidently into bat. Got the 5th ball on his left ear and retired to the 3 horseshoes. Mr. Harcourt was in next and suffered an innings dogged by severe misfortune.
Bad luck, Rupert.
It could have happened to anyone.
I suppose so. Just wish I'd managed to hit something. Well, other than the wicket, that is.
The score at the end of the first over stood at 10 runs for 2 wickets and 1 man retired hurt. A slow left-arm bowler was on at the other end, the local rate collector, a man whose whole life was one of infinite patience and guile. Off his 1st ball, the massive boon was easily stopped. Having executed a movement that aroused the professional admiration of the ancient, who was leaning on his scythe.
I expected something a bit better than that from him.
Why so, young Cameron?
Well, hang it all, he is a Cambridge Blue.
Yes, and he got it for rowing. I'm sure he'd be man of the match if we were playing beneath Putney Bridge.
Ah. Where else going in now? Look at him, Rupert, in his pink silk shirt. He looks like a fastball knocked the bat clean out of his hands.
Mm. Bobby, play carefully. Keep your end up. Runs don't matter.
Very well, Bill.
Who is he, Harcourt?
That, my boy, is our celebrity player, Mr. Robert Southcott.
What, the novelist?
Mr. Robert Southcott, the novelist, took guard modestly, glanced about him as if to suggest he wouldn't survive long enough to make a study of the fieldsman's positions worthwhile, and hit the rake collector's 1st ball over the 3 horseshoes into the hayfield. The ball was retrieved by a mob of screaming urchins and handed back to the rake collector, who scratched his head, then bowled his fast Yorker, which Mr. Southcott hit through the window of the makeshift pavilion.
Good God, he's worse than usual. Donald, this calls for evasive action. Come to the shoes!
I don't think I'd better. I haven't been in yet. What will Mr. Hodge say?
It's going to take me several pints to get over that.
The rake collector was bewildered that his reputation was in grave danger. The instalments would be harder to collect than ever, now his famous deliverers had been treated with such contempt. Another 6 and he'd be laughed out of the parish. Mercifully, the village umpire came to the rescue. 38 years at Fordenden Cricket Club had taught him a thing or two, and he called,
"Over!"
Then firmly marched off to square leg. At the other end, the village blacksmith pounded away grimly until an unfortunate accident occurred. It was the last ball of the over. The blacksmith halted at the wicket, glared at Mr. Harcourt, who'd been driven out to umpire by his captain in a bid to keep him out of the shoes, glared at Mr. Southcott, Harcourt took another reef in his belt, shook out another inch in his braces, spat on his hand, swung his arm three or four times in a meditative sort of way, grasped the ball tightly in his colossal palm, then marched off and vanished over the brow of the hill. During these proceedings, Mr. Southcott leant elegantly on his bat, admiring the view. At last, after a long stillness, the ground shook, the grasses waved violently, small birds arose with shrill clamours, a loud puffing sound alarmed the butterflies, and the blacksmith came thundering over the crest. The world held its breath. But alas for human ambitions, as the great whirlwind of volcanic energy rushed past him to the crease, Mr. Harcourt, quivering with mischief and wobbling uncertainly on his pins, bellowed,
"No ball!"
It was too late for the bowler to stop himself. The ball flew from his hand like a bullet and hit third slip, who wasn't looking, full pitch on the kneecap. Understandably, third slip began hopping about like a stork until he tripped over a tussock of grass and fell on his face in a bed of nettles. The blacksmith was flung forward by his own irresistible momentum, startled out of his wits by Mr. Harcourt's bellow in his ear, and thrown off balance by his desperate effort to stop himself delivering the ball. The result was his gigantic feet got tangled up and he fell heavily in the centre of the wicket, knocking up a cloud of dust and twisting his ankle. Rooks arose in their hundreds from the vicarage cedars. The urchins howled like intoxicated banshees. The gaffers gaped.
"Well, I'll be..."
"Aye, and me."
Mr. Southcott gazed modestly at the ground. Mr. Harcourt gazed at the heavens. Mr. Hodge surveyed the scoreboard with an imperial air.
"You needn't play safe anymore, Bob. Play your own game."
"Thank you, Bill."
On resumption of the game, Mr. Southcott fell into a kind of cricketing trance, defending his wicket from straight balls, ignoring crooked ones, and scoring one more run before allowing a ball to strike his person.
"Out!"
shrieked the venerable umpire before anyone had time to appeal. The score at this point, 69-6, last man 52. Opinion on the quality of this total was divided on the gaffer's bench.
"What do you think then, George? 69 a winning score is up?"
"Hey, well, it might be. Then again, it might not."
"No, I don't know if I agree with that."
The only other incident in the innings was provided by an American journalist by name Mr. Shakespeare Pollock, who'd been roped in at the last minute to make up the team. Striking the first ball he received towards square leg, Mr. Pollock threw down his bat and set off at an alarming rate in the direction of cover point. There was a paralysed silence. Mr. Pollock stopped suddenly.
"Darn me, I thought I was playing baseball!
Baseball's a kind of rounders, isn't it?"
Mr. Pollock walked back to the wicket in silence and was out next ball. The innings closed at 69 as Major Hawker, the team's fast bowler, failed to score, as did Mr. Hodge himself, and Donald was not out. Naught. After an interval for refreshment, Mr. Hodge led his men out into the field and placed them all at suitable positions in the hay. All, that is, except Mr. Harcourt, who was missing. The redoubtable fast bowler, Major Hawker, thrust out his chin and prepared to bowl. In a quarter of an hour, he terrified seven batsmen, clean bowled six of them, and broken a stump. 11 runs, 6 wickets, last man 2. After the fall of the 6th wicket, there was a slight delay.
"Hey, where's the major gone?"
These words galvanised Mr. Hodge into portentous activity.
"Quick! Hurry! Run! For God's sake! Bob! Shakespeare! Donald! To the shoes!"
But they were all too late. The gallant major, admitted through the back door, had already lowered a quart and a half of mild bitter, and his subsequent bowling consisted mainly of slow, gentle, full pitches to leg. The score mounted steadily. Disaster followed disaster. Presented with the chance of an easy run-out, Mr. Pollock had another reversion to his college days and flung the ball with appalling velocity at the unfortunate rake collector, hitting him in the small of the back.
Oh! Rah, rah, rah!
Mr. Livingston, the good club player, missed two easy catches off successive balls. Mr. Hodge allowed another easy catch to fall at his feet without even attempting to save it.
Yes, well, I was busy, wasn't I? I was looking at the Squire's oak tree. Very fine specimen.
Oh, that's all right, then.
Exactly.
A black spot happened to cross the eye of the village umpire just as the baker put all his feet, legs and pads in front of a perfectly straight ball.
LBW!
Oh, come on! LBW, you've got to give it.
I didn't see it. I have to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Didn't see it? How could you miss it?
A black spot crossed my eye, you see. It's not my fault if a black spot crosses my eye.
I'll cross your eye with a black one.
Worse still, the stout publisher seemed to be suffering from the delusion that the way to make a catch at the wicket was to raise both hands high in the air, utter a piercing yell, and trust to an immense pair of pads to secure the ball. Repeated experiments proved him wrong. 50-6. Things were desperate.
20 a win, George. It's 5 wickets.
Aye, we might do it. I'm not saying we won't.
No, nor me.
Still, you never know, do you?
No, that's very true.
Though I dare say we shall find out.
Very obvious.
That's true.
Putting himself into bowl, Mr. Hodge secured a crucial wicket off his first ball. It happened like this. He placed all his men on the leg side and delivered what can best be described as a slow, long hop on the off side. The rake collector, metaphorically rubbing his eyes, felt this was too good to be true, and he struck the ball sharply into the untenanted offside, then ambled down the wicket with as near an approach to gaiety as a man can achieve, when the very nature of his work cuts him off from the goodwill of his fellows. He'd hardly gone a yard or two when he was paralysed by an ear-splitting cry from the long grass. Mr. Harcourt, aroused from a deep slumber amid a comfortable couch of daisies, sprang to his feet, seized the ball, and unerringly threw down the wicket.
I knew he was out there somewhere.
20 to win, 4 wickets to 4. Mr. Hodge's next ball was his top spinner. It would probably have come very quickly off the ground, had it ever hit the ground. As it was, one of the short legs caught it dexterously, threw it back while the umpire signalled a wide. Mr. Hodge then tried out other extracts from his repertoire and was promptly hit for 2 sixes and a single. This brought the baker to the batting end. The next ball was not a good one, due mainly to the fact that it slipped out of Mr. Hodge's hand before he was ready, then went up and came down in a slow, lazy parabola about 7 feet wide of the wicket on the leg side. The baker had plenty of time to make up his mind. He could either leave it alone and let it count one run as a wide, or he could spring upon it like a panther and with a terrific 6 finish the match sensationally. The baker concealed a mounting ambition beneath his modest, flower-encrusted exterior. Here was a chance to show the village. He chose to spring like a panther, whirled his bat cyclonically, and missed the ball by about 1.5 feet. The wicket-keeping publisher had also had time to think and to move, and he too had covered the 7 feet. True, his movements were less like the spring of a panther than the sideways waddle of an aldermanic penguin, but nevertheless he got there, and when the ball had passed the flashing blade of the baker, he launched a mighty kick at it. Stooping to grab it was out of the question. By an amazing fluke, he punted it onto the wicket. The ancient umpire had no choice this time, for the baker was still lying flat on his face outside the crease.
I was bowling for that.
Well, you know, Bill, I have plenty of time to use my hands there, but I just thought I'd kick it instead.
Donald was impressed by the extraordinary subtlety of the game. 6 to win, 3 wickets to 4. The next batsman was a schoolboy of about 16, with pink cheeks and a nervous smile, who quickly fell victim to the now wide awake Mr. Harcourt.
I think it's the old jungle disappearing act for you, my lad.
The batsman at the other end played the fourth ball at Mr. Livingstone's next over, hard in the direction of Mr. Harcourt, who rushed to the spot where it had vanished in the long grass and appeared to grope wildly for it.
Come and help! It's lost!
True to form, the pink child scuttered nimbly down the pitch, but not nimbly enough to beat the returning lost ball. Mr. Harcourt smiled demonically. The crisis was now desperate. A snick through the slips brought a single. A ball which eluded the publisher's gigantic pads brought a bye. Then came another single off a mishit, and then an interminable period when no wicket fell and no run was scored. It was broken at last, disastrously, for the Fordenham postmaster struck the ball sharply at Mr. Pollock, who in an ecstasy of zeal flung it madly at the wicket. 2 overthrows resulted.
Level pegging now, George. 2 wickets to 4. What do you think?
I think it's 6 o'clock. Opening time.
I'm with you there.
Hey, but what about the game? Who's going to win?
Who cares?
The Major, his face redder than ever, bowled a fast half volley on the leg stump. The village sexton was batting, a man of iron muscle from much digging, and he hit it fair and square mid-bat. It flashed like a thunderbolt, waist high, and struck the mighty Boone in the midriff.
Oh.
Boone clapped his hands to his outraged stomach and found the ball was in the way. He looked at it in astonishment and then threw it down angrily and started to massage the injured spot while the field rang with applause at the brilliance of the catch.
Very well held, Mr. Byrne.
I didn't want to catch the bloody thing.
But you may have saved the side.
Blast the bloody side!
The scores were level, with 1 wicket to 4. Last man in was the blacksmith, leaning heavily on the shoulder of the baker, who was going to run for him. Still in a great rage, he lashed wildly at the first ball, hitting it high into the air, so high that it became hard to focus on properly. Up and up it went, carrying with it the hopes and fears of an English village. Meanwhile, below, on the terrestrial sphere, the blacksmith forgot his sprained ankle and set out at a capital rate, roaring in a great voice.
Come on, Joe!
The baker, running on his behalf, also set out, and he too roared. From the other end, Joe set out on his mission. So all three came on, and everything would have been all right had it not been for the fact that, very naturally, each man ran with his head thrown back and his eyes goggling at the hawk-like ball. Halfway down the pitch, the three met with a magnificent clang. The hopes of the village fell with the resounding fall of its 3 champions. And what of the fielding side? Major Hawker was coming up from the bowler's end like a battle cruiser. Mr. Harcourt had obviously lost sight of the ball altogether, for he was running round Boone, giggling foolishly. Livingstone and Southcott were approaching competently. Either would catch it easily. Mr. Hodge, coming to a swift decision, yelled above the din,
"Yours, Livingstone!"
Southcott stopped dead. Then Mr. Hodge made a fatal mistake. He remembered Livingston's two miss-hitters and reversed his decision.
No, yours, Bobby!
Mr. Southcott obediently started again. While Livingston went straight on, not having heard the second order, the ballistics professor calculated that the critical spot was 1 yard northeast of Boone. He took up station there, colliding on the way with Donald and knocking him over. Then Bobby Southcott raced up, tripping over the recumbent Donald and flying headfirst into the Abraham-like bosom of Boone, who stepped back a yard and came down with his spiked boot upon the professor's toe, just as the portly wicket-keeper bumped the poor professor from behind. At last, the ball came down, and it was a striking testimony to the professor's ballistic skill that it landed on top of his head. Thence it leapt in the air, cannon onto Boone's head, then trickled slowly down the colossal expanse of the wicket-keeper's back. It was only a foot from the ground when Mr. Shakespeare Pollock sprang into the vortex and grabbed it off the seat of the wicket-keeper's trousers. Match was a tie. Next week, Donald finds himself on slightly more familiar sporting territory, the golf course, though some of its technical terms are still beyond him.
Want a peg, Cameron?
Oh, no, I never drink this early.
And he visits Geneva to fathom the intricacies of international diplomacy.
My dear sir, we don't have policies about things.
Join us then.
Part 3 of England, There, England by A.G. MacDonald was adapted by Bob Sinfield and narrated by Leslie Phillips, with Sam Graham as Donald Cameron, Christopher Benjamin as Mr. Hodge, Peter Kelly as Mr. Harcourt, and Sean Prendergast as Mr. Southcott. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Graham Harper. The director was Neil Cargill. England There, England is a Splice of Life production for BBC Radio 2.